sometimes gets attention, I think, that is a little bit hyperbolic, in the sense that there's this sort of big human workaround. Rights holders, unfortunately, you know, to get people to buy things, do have to show it to you. The ideal thing, to be sure, would be to sell you a pay-per-view on a book, but you get zero views, because that way, for sure, you wouldn't be able to copy it if you couldn't look at it at all. Unfortunately, as soon as you start letting people read things, you know, they can transcribe them, they can take notes, write them down. So there's this sort of big human workaround that's a safety net. The entertainment industry folks call this the analog hole sometimes, which is an interesting piece of rhetoric. This becomes more problematic, though, when we talk about multimedia. While it's certainly one thing as an author to read somebody else's words, take some notes, write them down, we really have to come to some kind of societal agreements about what it means to quote in a society where visual and moving images are important parts of our communication. Just look at areas of cultural and film and video studies. These people want to analyze and write about films, and sometimes they can't clear the rights for even a single frame of the film they want to write about, and their publishers are too risk-averse to run to print and publish a book with those frames. We really need to think about these kinds of issues. Now, flipping over to other concerns, though, a set that I feel very deeply about are these questions about archiving. Some of this comes down to what in the States we refer to as the doctrine of first sale, the sort of notion that once you buy an object, like a book, that while you may be prevented from making copies of it, except under some very specific circumstances, that it's yours to lend, it's yours to keep, it's yours to share. And this is, you know, the sort of fundamental enabling legislation for libraries, in a sense, being able to loan out things that they buy in the States. This is the fundamental enabling legislation for collecting. Now, we seem to be inching towards a world that's much more about turning goods into rental goods, into experiential goods, into things that can be withdrawn from market or sold again and you have to pay for it again, very much at the whim of the rights holders. World where we can, you know, generate amnesia about things. We can, you know, reduce things to people's memory at pretty much the whim of rights holders. This is a very scary world to me, and one that I think is equally important in the long run to address in our thinking about what kind of a world of copyright and intellectual property we want to have.
Actually, I really appreciate your comments. It's nice sometimes to have an outside voice even looking at it and refreshing our debate, because I think we've at the stage now looking at legislation where we're beginning to argue practically about the semicolons and the commas, and we do need to step back and look at some of the larger pictures. You have talked about one of the key missions of libraries in dealing with equity of access or digital divide or whatever we want to call it in terms of the provision of that technology inside libraries. Another one of those cornerstone or emerging key missions that people point to during an age of information and technologies is information literacy and the library role of where we fit in terms of that responsibility for information literacy. And I'm just going to mention the two words and turn it over to you to for some comments.
Oh, my. This is a very tough subject, actually. And depending on what day you get me on, I find myself coming up with radically different answers. I was talking with my friend Jeff Nunberg about this the other day, and you know, he has done a lot of studying of the reading habits of various social classes over time. and reminds me that literacy itself is a very elusive concept. Once you get past the, you know, sort of most fundamental idea of literacy as being able to read and understand words, you know, can you understand signage? Can you understand a restaurant menu? Can you understand simple instructions and things like that? Once you get beyond that relatively kind of mechanical thing, we do, you know, have a much more elaborated notion of literacy. But this is a enormously slippery concept which seems to be somewhat idiosyncratic, he tells me, to the English-speaking world, and considerably idiosyncratic to modern times. It's one that the meaning of which has shifted enormously. For example, you know, there was a time when there were a significant number of people who knew how to read, but what they did was they owned 8 or 10 books, a Bible, a couple of, classics, pieces of the classics, Virgil or something, and they read it intensively. They memorized a lot of it. They, you know, pored over it and drew philosophic and moral lessons from it. And then there was a shift when a lot more works became available, and they tended to read more extensively rather than intensively, and the whole sort of sense of what it meant to be literate started to change. Couple this with another really murky word like information, and I think we've really produced a concoction that we don't understand. Having said that, there are clearly problems with information literacy if you allow me to define that, for example, as some understanding of the sources that are available to people seeking information. If you allow me to define it as the ability to do a certain amount of critical and indeed skeptical and even paranoid analysis of the accuracy, bias, and motivation of various sources, to try and figure out among a multiplicity of sources which ones are likely to be right, which ones are not likely to be right, how the different sources interrelate to each other, how echo chamber effects occur among multiple sources, all of this kind of thing. People's ability on this can cover a vast range of stuff. People who do various kinds of intelligence work, be it in the, you know, governmental or commercial sector, are very good often at analyzing sources and their interrelations and cascading effects. Clearly, we've got some problems in this area. I would invite you, if you really want a sort of a sobering read, to have a look at a survey that came out, I believe, last week or maybe late the week before from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. They do surveys and produce lots of sort of interesting stuff, mm-hmm. where they go out and talk to various populations about how are you using the Internet and what are you making of what you find and what use are you putting it to. They talk to people who use search engines, and some of the things they learned were not surprising. You know, a lot of people use search engines, and they work pretty well. Okay. Then they ask them about things like, do you know what paid placement is in search engine results? No. Do you know how to identify it? No. Are you worried about it? Well, I'm not sure. The number of folks among the interview base that they looked at that understood these sort of basic things was, at least to me, disturbingly low. Now, I don't know, honestly, how people stand with print ads. I'm not clear how many people understand the difference between advertising in newspapers and articles in newspapers. I'm not sure how many people understand the difference between ads on television and television shows, and I guess I'm not sure there is a difference sometimes. as I say that, but I'm not sure how much better off we are in more traditional media, but I do sense there's a real problem here. Now, what do we do about this? Well, it seems to me that a big part of this really shouldn't be dumped on libraries. It really should fall to our educational system. And it should go, way deep into elementary education and all the way back. It should be part of, growing up just like, learning to read and learning to count and learning to deal with the world. It doesn't have a natural place in most American curriculums for K through 12 that I've looked at. There's no obvious place they put it except a little bit in, English class where it tends to get reduced to writing book reports and other things that don't really quite get at this. So in an ideal world, I think you can argue that this is something that the educational system should take the lead on and libraries should be there to support and enrich in the same way that they support and enrich the educational system, but they aren't the educational system.
Now, they don't really do it much for print or for radio or for television, in part because, to an extent, and since we've lived with them so long, the context is obvious. You see an ad in a newspaper, you know it's an ad. You see an ad on television, maybe less obvious, but you pretty well know it's an ad. But sometimes, because of paying for placement and because of various things on the web, you're not always aware of. And isn't that an advantage to the advertiser that they're using?
I wish I shared your confidence about that. I really do. I worry, honestly, that there are an awful lot of ads, especially ads that are made up not to look like ads, where a lot of people really can't tell. And I have not seen data that really gets at that. I think, actually, that there is a somewhat bigger, concern about people being able to do this kind of critical analysis of sources than just the net. And, we certainly continue to see issues about governments and others and industry paying for placement in things that looks like news media.
Mm-hmm.
We've just had a big scandal with that in the States. It's an eternal scandal. So I actually think there's kind of a broader issue. I think that it may be a little more acute in the network environment, in the digital environment, but it's very real. Now, okay, so in an ideal world, you can say libraries should just be kind of a backup and an enricher like they are with education. But this is an area where I think our education system, particularly in K through 12, is failing rather severely, that it isn't even on their agenda. So you see some courses at the college level trying to do this. You see libraries of all kinds trying to grapple with this, and often, honestly, trying to grapple with it transactionally. How often have you seen frontline librarians in either academic or public settings, and I don't say corporate just because I don't know. I don't, go in that world that often. Basically trying to help someone or teach someone how to write a term paper or how to write an essay because nobody else is teaching them. They have a need. The librarian knows something about this and can be helpful, and they're filling the gap the best they can. And we're seeing this, again and again and again, played out around information literacy kinds of issues, if you're willing to characterize information literacy as these kind of critical analysis and navigational skills.
Now, we're getting down to the last few minutes, but I've got two topics I'd love to have a comment on. And one of them, because you have mentioned search engines, and years ago you introduced me to the concept of the deep web, and as being an expression used for the mediated, the juried resources, the items that are not available just through a general search engine. And I think that's another one of those missions that that libraries have adopted, is the provision of good mediated information. But it does seem to me that as some of the search engines become more sophisticated, as they're attracting new eyes, that they're beginning to move into that world as well and licensing the same products that we potentially are going to be licensing. Is that yet another threat to another area that we've identified as being a key mission.
I don't know whether I'd characterize it as a threat, honestly, but I think something very important is happening, and it's happening without people fully recognizing the ramifications. Ever since we had web indexers, we've had this sort of concept of the deep web or the dark web, as it's variously called. Sometimes it's called the invisible web. Basically, these are things that are in databases that only manifest themselves as dynamically produced web pages in response to queries. Or there are things that are behind barriers of various kinds, licensing and authentication barriers. For example, all of the resources that libraries cite license on behalf of their patron communities are typically viewed as part of the deep web in the sense that the web indexing services, the Googles and the Yahoos and their predecessors, the Alta Vistas and the Inktomis, remember all those guys, couldn't get to them. Now, something very interesting is starting to happen, which is that not just Google, but the other remaining competitors to Google, the folks like Yahoo, are cutting deals now to get into pieces of this dark web and index it. Witness, for example, Google Scholar. Witness some of the outreach that Yahoo is doing to publishers. Now, up till now, most of the writing that I've seen and most of the analysis I've seen about this has been about, oh gosh, this just means a few more things are going to show up that historically people had to go through libraries and special finding tools for, and now they're going to show up scattered around Google search results, and, you know, is that a threat to libraries or not? Let me give you a few other things to think about here. One thing that's happening is that all of a sudden we are creating much higher barriers to entry for new web indexing services. Just think about this carefully. When Google came along, it was a couple of computer science graduate students from Stanford who had a better idea about an algorithm to apply to the public web so that they could rank pages and respond to queries with ranked responses in a more useful way than the preceding services. And all they needed in order to do this, to go and compete with all the existing players, was enough computational cycles and enough network bandwidth to go out there to index the web. That's pretty easy to get, relatively speaking, at least to get started. Now, everybody's doing deals with content providers to get into that dark web. If you want to be a new entry competitive search engine player, it's no longer enough to have a good algorithm, some cycles, and some network connectivity. In order to be competitive in the scope of content you index, you have to do deals with all of these content providers who may not want to do deals with you because you're a small new startup that nobody's ever heard of. It's going to be a very different environment, and one in which we suddenly erected much higher barriers of entry for new search engine players. It's an environment where we now are going to see, rather than different search engines potentially presenting the same material where we can compare them, different search engines covering different material, which is going to be problematic in numerous ways. It's going to be a very different world. It's a world that used to be mostly about technical excellence, and it's a world that may, in another few years, be a lot more about who you know and who your allies are, a lot more like the sort of thing that the media companies do, where it's all about who you know and who you can make deals with. So that's one area where I really see things changing. The other message that's implicit here is about players trusting each other. When you look at search engines going in the dark web, when you look at dark web content providers making themselves available to search engines, depending on the specifics of that, it's saying things about one party agreeing to trust each other. And this is very different than the environment the search engines operated in before, where they essentially were trying to index a world of sources that were often engaged in actively trying to sabotage or deceive or fake out in various ways the indexing services. So I see what's going on here as a pretty significant environmental change that we need to recognize the consequences of.
And the last question, and it really does deal with the, I suppose, the balance between personalization and privacy.
Mm-hmm.
At least it seems to me that the desire for personalization, the comfort of comfort, the ease of convenience for personalization, allow and encourage many people to want the elements of personalization. But there is a balance there between the privacy types of issues. And that line is consistently moving. There is a different sense of acceptance, even generationally, between what people are willing to accept as being a price of personalization. And I just wondered if you wanted to talk about that type of that balance between personalization and privacy.
Sure. I mean, that's a really central issue for the future of libraries. When I look at what's happened over the last decade, the commercial sector has recognized that with abundant storage, with abundant computing power, and with more and more of people's activities and belongings and interactions occurring digitally and therefore being subject to capture and recording, you know, a purchase history, the contents of your personal library, your preferences, what you go look at, all of this kind of thing, that given those prerequisites, you can now build computer systems that do a couple of things. The first thing they can do is tailor themselves in increasingly adaptable, powerful, and useful ways to individual needs and interests. And you can see that in your experiences shopping on many commercial services or using many commercial services. Very useful, and really has sort of set the expectation for consumers about what an interaction with an information service should be like. The second thing that you can do once you start being able to characterize aspects of people is you can start doing social things with them. You can match them up. You can build communities on the fly. You can say, let me introduce you to other people who have common interests. Or you can factor the people out, as a recommender system does, and say, I'm not going to tell you who else is buying this, but I'm going to tell you that there are people out there who buy a lot of the same things you do, and here's something a lot of them bought that you haven't yet, and we thought you'd be interested in it. A recommender system. So these two things, the ability to tailor and then the ability to do social and community computations, are very powerful and very valuable and very useful services. They are services that, frankly, most consumers have traded away a lot of privacy for without worrying very much. I mean, there's evidence that while a lot of people, if you survey them, say, is privacy important to you? We'll say, oh, absolutely. But then we'll cheerfully blow off all their privacy in exchange for, you know, a 5% off coupon or getting frequent flyer miles or something like that. Now, it seems to me that there are a couple of things going on here. One thing that's going on is that libraries have taken a principled but absolutist position, at least in the States. Basically, what libraries have said is, We do not collect personal information except to the absolute minimum extent necessary to operate. We will keep track of who's borrowed a book as long as that book is out on loan so that we can make sure we get it back. But as soon as it comes back, we'll destroy that record so that there's no question of somebody subpoenaing it or otherwise laying hands on it. So absolute minimum amount of personal data for the minimum length of time. Now, basically, what that is that's a way of saying libraries saying, rather than giving patrons choices to opt in and to have us use informed consent and good judgment and good practices to try and keep things as private as possible while still giving you some benefits of community, of social connection, of personalization, libraries have simply said, we aren't going there. And what it's led to is a system, a set of library systems that really look very old-fashioned and stupid and clunky when you compare them to the shopping experiences that people have online. They make libraries look very poor by comparison. And libraries have done this, as I say, for very principled reasons. I would suggest that libraries are really missing an opportunity here. If a library says, you know, we will protect your data as best we can, understand that it may be subject to subpoena, understand also that we will allow you to go off the record and become anonymous whenever you want to, that if you change your mind and ask us to destroy data, we will. If you enter into that kind of an agreement with a library, wouldn't you think that probably they're more likely to be scrupulous about honoring it than your corporation that has some 22-page privacy statement and says, oh, your privacy is important to us, and then goes about its business? I think most people would say, yeah, I feel a little better about the library. So I think there's a great missed opportunity here, and my sense is that most people aren't that secretive, aren't that protective of a lot of the information seeking they're doing. In fact, they'd love to have other people who share common interests, who share common questions to talk to about. Sure, there are times when they want to go off the record completely. They want to be anonymous. They know what many of those times are. And libraries can play a real service by talking to them, by communicating to them and saying, you need to make choices about when you want to be on the, you know, completely off the radar screen, and when you're really looking both for information and for side benefits of social connections or cross-referencing or other things that those community interactions may bring you. So that's a little bit about where I'm thinking on those kinds of issues.
Geez, if I had one regret, it's that I didn't ask you that question much sooner, you know, because I would love to go into that a little bit more. I mean, I certainly view it as being, we are one of the aspects of the period of time we have now is we don't have a monopoly service anymore. We are part of competition. One of the first rules when you do have competition is to know who your customers are, who they aren't, what they want, what your competition is offering. And from what I hear you saying as well, is you're suggesting this as both a service area and as an area to know your customer more?
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to talk about that, because there is, of course, a heavy discomfort area in terms of privacy.
And it's also one where you have reputation to build on. Libraries have been vigorous and good defenders of privacy. They have been scrupulous in this area. They have really stood up for privacy over the years. And because of that, I think you have a well-earned and legitimate basis of trust from which you can build. I think it's important to build very carefully, to not put that trust in doubt and in peril by making bad choices. But I think that there also are great opportunities to make thoughtful choices.
I mean, obviously, and I'm sure you would say that's one you have to enter into very, very carefully.
Yeah.
That any time they do the studies, it certainly indicates that the word library, you know, resonates and creates a great deal of comfort, and people like it when they hear the term. but they like it for a variety of reasons, and probably one of them is that sense of protection.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to give up any element of that it is probably something you do very carefully.
Yeah. And just to give you a sense of how carefully, you know, when people talk about records in libraries and not keeping them, the sort of you know, vision that they talk about as well, if we keep them, they can be subpoenaed. Law enforcement can get a hold of them, or maybe even civil cases could get a hold of them through the courts. That's one real risk, but I just want to remind you it's not the only one. How secure are your library systems? Where does it leave you when some person, because they think it would be fun, hacks into your library system, and let's say you're keeping these histories, and decides to publish on the net the search and interest histories of assorted popular and well-known citizens in your community. Now, that's not a legal thing. That's a place where you messed up on a security and IT kind of thing, but I just want to remind you that, you know, the couplings with privacy and with, you know, your sort of pact of trust with the public are much more complicated than just the legal environment. So I think that just, again, is a reminder of how careful and how thoughtful you want to be in exploiting that opportunity.
Okay, thank you. And that's it. I would remind you all that Clifford is actually on day two of a 23-day trip. So I'm glad we got you at the beginning. I've heard you at the beginning of trips. I've heard you at the end of the trips. You're always wonderful, and you're wonderful again today.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
That's great.